to me, meaning is more tractable than purpose. When you're a 15-year-old kid, that can seem very daunting to be like, today, students, we're going to give you a purpose. You know, like, now I think that students want a purpose. If they had it, they would love it. But we don't need to like shame them, you know, if they don't have it, you know, and saying that, well, they have to have it at the age of 15. But I think that we can give them more of a sense of meaning by even just connecting the material that you're teaching them to the relevance to their own life, to the relevance to the future.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This is the Fueling Creativity Podcast.
On this show, we'll be talking about creativity topics and how they apply to the field of education.
We'll be speaking with scholars, educators, and resident experts about their work, challenges they face, and digging deeper into new and varying perspectives of creativity.
All with the goal to help fuel a more rich and informed discussion that provides teachers and parents with knowledge they can use at home or in the classroom.
So let's begin.
We are thrilled to be kicking off season two with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. Scott is a cognitive scientist and humanistic psychologist. He is the founder and director of the Center for the Science of Human Potential and the author of several books, including Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, Wired to Create, and most recently, Transcend, the New Science of Self-Actualization. Scott hosts the number one psychology podcast in the world, the Psychology Podcast. And I promise if you like this podcast, you will definitely like his. So go and check it out. His research focuses on how to help all kinds of minds live creative, fulfilling, and self-actualized lives. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Cindy. Great to chat with you.
Great to have you here today with us. So today we're going to be talking about your most recent book, Transcend, the New Science of Self-Actualization. In this book, you reimagine Maslow's famous hierarchy of needs, which we have typically seen as a pyramid with self-actualization at the top. What led you to take a deep dive into this model? And what did you discover?
Yeah, the history of why I got into writing that book is that I was teaching a course at University of Pennsylvania on positive psychology, and I was preparing for the history lecture of my class. And when I dived into sort of the literature on the foundations of the field of positive psychology, and I discovered Abraham Maslow, I was smitten. Loved the way he wrote, just the kind of the flow of his words resonated with me. There's just so much that resonated with me. And as I like to do with anything, I like to, you know, sort of go all in, you know, with something that I'm interested in. And I noticed that you could purchase the diaries of Abraham Maslow on Amazon. And it was like ranked 5 billion, suggesting no one else had ever read it. And I was like, wow, you know, like it's like discovering a band before other people do, you know, sort of thing. And so I bought the 2-volume, 1,000-page set, and I spent months just sitting down in my room in Philadelphia and my apartment in Philadelphia and just reading, you know, cover to cover, his personal thoughts and his aspirations, his dreams, everything, just like getting really intimate with this person I've never met. And I realized a bunch of things. I realized, well, first of all, he never drew a pyramid. You know, I was like, wow, there's no pyramid. And I also realized, you know, he really didn't think self-actualization was the highest human motivation. He really thought transcendence was. And it quickly turned into a feeling, kind of sense of mission to write a book, kind of set the record straight, but also to, you know, just extend, if I may be so bold as to say, I didn't just, you know, recap his work, but, you know, I talked about how it's can be updated in the light of all the research that has the great research, not just I have conducted, but a lot of people have done great research, and kind of bring it all together and integrate it.
So after you wanted to integrate it, tell us about this new model that you've created with the sailboat.
Oh, I'd be happy to. There was this, you know, the original sort of pyramid that people know about, and it's so clunky. It's so non-dynamic, or I guess I should say static. It's so static. But a sailboat metaphor seems to work better. And that was the suggestion, by the way, that came up by my illustrator, Andy Ogden. That was his idea. So I want to give Andy credit. But the sailboat captures, because I was explaining to him, I was like, we need something that captures the fact that you have stability or security needs, and then you have growth needs. And the boat doesn't, it's of itself, the hull does a nice job capturing the security that you need. If you have too many holes in your boat, you're going to sink and you're certainly not going to move. So you have, your basic needs for security and your basic needs for connection, basic needs for self-esteem. But just having your boat secure, you're not going to move unless you open up the sail. You might be stable in a certain spot, but eventually you have to open up the sail to grow. So both those components, the boat and the sail, really did a nice job capturing these two kinds of class of needs that Maslow focused on, but I tried to continue, carry forth.
As a metaphor, hearing you speak about the sailboat, there's also so many wonderful connections about life with just sailboats. I've just finished reading a book about the voyages of Captain James Cook, and you listen to all these storms that take place as they make their voyage around, and you can kind of make that analogy to the storms that we experience in life. But then also the motivation that has taken the human race all around the world throughout millennia, these small canoes that we jump on and just kind of like constantly have this desire to go out and discover. And I think that also maybe connects in some way to growth. So I just wanted to share that I think that analogy, the sailboat analogy, is just super cool just to think about life in general.
Thank you. Yeah, very much the part of the point there about exploration is spot on. That's the core foundation of the sail, whereas the core foundation of the boat is safety. And Maslow has this great quote. I mean, you can choose to go back towards safety. You can choose to go forward towards growth. You have to keep choosing the growth option again and again and overcoming the fear response again and again. And that's roughly the quote. I think he probably said it better. But that's the general idea. Yeah.
And keeping with the theme of safety, because this came up on a previous episode of the Fueling Creativity podcast, and I don't think we had enough time to really dig deeper into that topic. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about how we as educators might do more to establish a safe environment for our students. And more importantly, how that effort can actually help leverage some of the unique abilities that may exist in children who have had disadvantaged backgrounds or challenges earlier in life.
Well, that's really a softball question for me, because that's I think about that question every day of my life. It's a beautiful question as well. Not softball in the sense that it's still a beautiful question, but it's a beautiful question. But for me, in thinking about that, I think we need humanistic approach to the question, kind of a humanistic lens. I've been thinking about what humanistic education could look like, and one that treats students as humans first. Not, we kind of treat them like robots, don't we? Or machines, input-output machines, and being able to start with this very safe base among students who feel very unsafe because they rightly feel unsafe in various ways. In one way, if they don't do well on a test, they fail. It's not like a safe space where if you you really put in all the hard work to study and you put your all into something and you don't make the cut, that like they say, like, oh, hey, we really love the effort you put towards it. These are some ways which you went wrong. We're going to allow you to take our feedback and revise it. It just, you don't see that often. You see kind of that one-shot testing sort of situation. But also there's lots of other ways. I mean, in inner city schools and poor neighborhoods, there's a lot of, I would say, food uncertainty, which when I was writing my book, my mind was blown the extent to which food uncertainty really impacts the cognition and lots of other aspects of a child's potential. So kind of standing on that base of security is super important, because otherwise it pervades our whole consciousness. It pitches us into a state of psychological entropy when there's too much uncertainty in our environment. I mentioned food uncertainty, but there could also be like violence in one's surroundings, or lots of other kind of conditions like discord of the family at home, lots of fighting among the parents. Well, we've found all these kinds of factors really do play a role in learning.
In the book, you referenced about micro connections, being able to make these micro connections to help establish relationships with your students. Can you talk a little bit about these micro connections, also perhaps from a parenting perspective and a humanistic perspective as we're interacting with people in our work environment as well?
Well, I think that's a term Barbara Fredrickson uses and certainly deserves credit for in her Love 2.0 book. She talks about the micro connections that we can have with each other that kind of sync up our brains and cause us, you know, when two people's brains are synced up together, and it can be a beautiful thing. You kind of get in that flow state where you're not thinking about yourself anymore. You know, you're not being, you know, I'm not being my normal neurotic Scott. You know, I'm like in this kind of more peaceful moment where I'm really connecting with another human, and a lot of my ordinary concerns evaporate, and I'm really present. And there's a real sense of connection there. But, you know, I distinguish between connection and love in my book, and higher forms of love, like more spiritual forms, what Maslow called be love, or love for the being of another person. So being love. And I think we also have to be careful to not only pay attention to those that we're micro connecting with, even though it's very, very important. I also have a firm belief that we need to open up our minds and be curious and explorative towards people that maybe we're not feeling an instant connection to, but just still trying to get to know them and understand them if they're very different from us. So that's my add-on to your question.
I want to go back for a moment to the safety piece, because in your book, Scott, you talked about students who were disruptors and students whose behaviors were poor, and how we often see them and dismiss those students, or we struggle with those students. And you talked about the skills that those students develop, the students that are going through challenging times, and how they develop a different skill set. So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that and what we might do to help maximize their potential in the classroom?
Yeah, this was asked a little bit earlier about students that may think differently or have, I think you used the word challenges, perhaps, students who have challenges. Well, I'm interested in this emerging educational movement called twice exceptionality. Twice exceptional students are students who simultaneously have gifts in various areas, but also have some significant learning challenges. Now, the point there is that they're human too. And so the basic needs that I talk about in my book, it's not like the rules don't apply to them, but it could apply to them in different ways. In some ways, we need to be even more cognizant of whether or not we're meeting these needs in those children. Because, you know, when you're isolated in a special education classroom, for instance, you really feel this loneliness. I mean, I can say, you know, that's how I felt as a kid in special education because of an auditory disability I had. The need for connection is severely thwarted with other people in the school. You know, I think there could be greater integration between various special education and even gifted education and the mainstream education, so students don't feel like they're so isolated. But also, it's so important to not let a person's label limit the totality of their being. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes schools spend so much time on remediation when a child has issues that they forget there's growth in the child. And there's, you know, they never open up the sail. They never let the kid open up the sail and move forward. I mean, I could say that as a child, again, as personal experience. I took a standard geometry class. I think it was algebra, and I loved it. And I remember at the end of the semester, I remember the teacher going desk by desk, discussing with the student what they would take the following semester. And I could hear him say to, you know, Johnny, you did great this semester. I think you should take honors class next semester. I remember my heart pounding because all I wanted was him to say that to me, because I got straight A's. I was like a model student that semester, and all I wanted him to say to me was, I think you're ready for honors. So he got to me. He's like, Scott, I really love the hard work you put in this semester. You work so hard, and you really earned your A. I think you're ready to not have to take this class again. And you know, you can you know, go on to the standard next level. And you know, I knew that he was viewing me through the lens of my special education, you know, and he wasn't seeing the person in front of him as a whole human being on its own terms, who could actually, maybe I was actually smart. Maybe it wasn't just I was just putting in work, you know? I mean, what's really different from me and Johnny, you know? I remember really upsetting me, and that I don't think I've ever told the story before, actually. But when I went back to War Marine High School to visit Dr. Kashmir, I remember going to him later as an adult, and walking past his classroom, and he was just sitting there by his desk. And I was like, "Hey, do you remember?" He's like, "Scott, yeah, of course I remember you." And I said, "Hey, I just want to tell you about that time you went to my desk that really upset me." And he looked like he was gonna cry. He was like, he was upset that I was upset. He's like, "I'm so sorry. I never thought of that. I never gave that a second thought. I assumed because you were in special ed, you weren't capable of anything." I was like, "Thanks." So anyway, that's a really long story, and I've never told that before. I mean, I feel like I was a little bit long winded there, but I think it's really important, you know, when you're an educator, to not reduce a student to their label and view them through that lens entirely. And you know, we view some students who we say, if we have in their lens, they're gifted. They may work really hard, but we might actually overlook that and say, "Oh, well, they just got it because they're gifted," you know. So I think that in lots of ways this can operate. Does it make sense?
It does. And what I'm taking away here is, I'm not sure if as educators in those moments we are qualified to make a judgment on what door should be closed and what door should be opened. And what I mean by that as well is that we probably need to be more mindful of how our words might be interpreted as opening and closing a door. I mean, I certainly won't share somewhat of a similar story, but I remember walking away from an incident saying, "I'm not a good writer." Mm-hmm. And still to this day, I perceive myself as not being a good writer. But ironically, I'm saying that state of flow is typically when I'm writing. And so I've got this really weird relationship with writing as a consequence of this eighth grade class. And then I also want to come back to the metaphor with, and I'm sorry to keep coming back to this, I get excited about something, but it was almost, you're making me think about this education system that's saying, "Hey, you're going to go off on this voyage of discovery in your sailboat. We don't know what the weather's going to be like, but you're going to follow these directions. Everyone's going to be the same. You're all going to arrive at the same time." And that's just not realistic. I mean, those boats are going to kind of like take off from the same port, but they're going to go in lots of different directions and land in lots of different places and at different times and experience different places. And we just need to be open and accept that's education, that's children. And we've got to, that's the big takeaway, is just be careful that we don't open or close any doors with our words.
Yes. And also, I think we need to just open more doors, and then if it doesn't work, yeah, then it doesn't work. Put them back in the remedial. But just try it. Teachers are more likely to err on the side of caution and traditional parochialism than actually just taking a risk and saying, "Look, I think this person, we can push this child more, you know. I think we can give them more opportunities."
So I sort of skipped your self-esteem because I really want to get exploration, because I really think when I was listening to your audiobook, that's where creativity really comes alive, is in exploration. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Exploration is where it's at. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's it. Exploration comprises six sub needs in my book. So it's comprehensive. Mm-hmm. It's one word, but it has many manifestations. You know, it could take the form of adventure seeking or social exploration or cognitive exploration, like openness to experience, being open to new experiences or and ideas and imagination or intellectual curiosity. It could take the form of it could even take the form of post-traumatic growth processing, you know, as a form of exploration of your own, quote, negative emotions, you know.
So let's dig into that. So, Scott, do you think that we can teach students how to be more open to experience? And if so, how do we do that?
I do. I think that we can teach students or encourage students to hold off on their judgments, hold off on their preconceived sort of form streams of cognition, to allow and witness what is in front of them as though it were for the first time, even if they have seen it many, many times before. So I don't know it's like asking the question, can you teach creativity? I mean, this is a big question. This is You've devoted your entire life to this, Cindy. But I think the jury's still out that whether you can teach creativity, like in the sense of like a set of rules, you know, like can like standardize mm-hmm. a teaching curriculum. But I think it makes sense to say that certainly you can move the dial on creativity in people. I taught a course at Columbia, Creativity in the Good Life was the name of the course. And I had this football player on the first day of my class who was convinced he wasn't creative. He said, I'm taking this class, but honestly, I'm like the least creative person. I'm just a football player. Well, by the end of that semester, he had been looking at himself in a completely different light. And he was like, the people on the football team, they now think I'm the most creative person on the team. You know, and he's like, I, you know, took a lot of the like sort of the science of creativity and applied it on the football field and like have been, I was like, you know, I'm more flexible, adaptable, open to new situations. You know, I'm not as rigid in my way of thinking about only this play can work in this situation. And so now, did I teach him how to be more creative on the football field? No, because I don't even know, you know, what that would, how to do that. But I do like football though. I do like football. But I don't know how I would do that if someone just said, Scott, design a curriculum to help football players be more creative. I don't know what I would do. But my teachings still helped him, you know, in his own way, in his own style. So I think we need to encourage people to be more open to experience, be more, you know, just have more of the explorative spirit. You know, it's a spirit that can be infused in any of us with a volitional choice.
I love that. And I think that's one of the pieces that really excited me when I was going through your book, because it's something that I think, you know, when you asked about how do you teach creativity, I always start with openness and being open to new ideas. And I have my students monitor their judgment for 24 hours to see what kind of things they judge, how they judge, why they judge, and then come back and talk to me about judgment. And what I find most interesting is that they're always talking about how they judge themselves and how critical and harsh they are to themselves, and how even after 20 some years of being in this field, I still find myself judging ideas and right as they're coming out of someone's mouth, and how I catch myself and how I'm talking to my children and my students and my family members in this way, that, you know, we have to keep open to each other and keep open to something new that might be brought up that might seem uncomfortable. But I really think it's a skill that you need to practice your whole life. Like, it's not something that you just become good at and all of a sudden, like, you don't have to think about it anymore. I think it's just an innate part of who we are that we have to manage.
So yeah, for some people, I do think there's, you know, individual differences. Mm-hmm. For me, I think I was so off the charts high in openness, it just biologically, mm-hmm. that I think my problem is I needed, and I probably even today, I need to tone it down sometimes. So I think some people have the reverse problem. They, you know, they need to, like, you know, like, I don't do well in a room of stuffy people, like, you know, a room of closed-minded, stuffy people. I don't do well in those rooms because I can't help myself but say something that's going to offend them, or like not offend, but maybe like just like ruffle the feathers a little bit, just because that's the way my mind works. I can't help it. Like, it's, I can't be so closed-minded. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like you get what I'm saying.
Oh, I definitely get what you're saying. So Scott, we're running out of time and I want to make sure we hit on purpose. So here's what I'd love to hear as your final piece for our podcast. I'd love to know from you how we can help our students at any age find their purpose.
In 30 seconds.
I was thinking 29, but you know, I'll give you an extra couple seconds if you need to.
That's a big question, and one which, you know, some of my colleagues have done better work than I have on that topic. Like William Damon at Stanford, you know, has devoted his life to understanding how to cultivate purpose in children. I look at that work, you know, for prompts and answers to that question. Personally, when I'm talking to teachers and they want to know, you know, their students feel a lack of meaning. See, to me, meaning is more tractable than purpose. When you're a 15-year-old kid, like, that can seem very daunting to be like, today, students, we're going to give you a purpose. You know, like, now I think that students want a purpose. They if they had it, they would love it. But we don't need to like shame them, you know, if they don't have it, you know, and saying that, well, they have to have it at the age of 15. You know, maybe they won't get it till they're 40 or 80. You know, I think actually we need to kind of make that clear. But I think that we can give them more of a sense of meaning by even just connecting the material that you're teaching them to the relevance to their own life, to the relevance to the future. Now, is that a purpose? No, it's not a purpose, but I think that, you know, that there's a start to purpose by leading with something more tangible, such as meaning making, you know, like Jerome Bruner style, you know, meaning making, you know, helping students have greater clarity over the narrative of who they are and their identity and its relevance to why they're learning in the first place. I think that, yeah, I just, you know, that this is just my personal answer, and people may disagree with that, but I think that's the beginning and seeds of building up to more of a calling. But I think very few 15-year-olds are going to have a calling already. And for the few that have it, that's great. But for the rest that don't, I don't think that they need to feel such pressure, because you know, life is this journey in the sea, and one purpose at one age. You know, there's one. Look, I've had different ideas about what my purpose was going to be. I thought I was going to be a computer scientist. You know, at one point in my life, when I was a computer hacker, in my teens, I thought, oh, I'll be a computer scientist. And then sometimes I thought I would be a Broadway singer. My purpose was to be on Broadway, to be an opera singer another time, stand-up comedian another time. You know, these things change throughout our lives.
And I think what's really interesting is it also brings up the intellectual curiosity that you talked about in exploration. For me, when I'm working with, especially like teenagers, as you mentioned, like getting them intellectually curious in something that leads them to questioning things and wondering about things, that can help lead them to some sort of identification of meaning and purpose. But I think that intellectual curiosity piece that you talked about is so critical in terms of leading up to that purpose.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And allowing people to have, allowing them to have intellectual curiosity. You know, you can see a lot of teachers, that's a threat to them, you know, when a student has intellectual curiosity, because the teacher has a lesson plan to get through, and they're so wedded to the lesson plan that they can't go off on too many detours.
So, Scott, we're about out of time, but we want to continue a routine that we had in our first season of the Fueling Creativity podcast and have our guests offer three takeaway tips that educators can apply in the classroom, or even just three tips to initiate some thinking on their end.
Yeah, tip from a teacher perspective, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to tie together some of the different threads we talked about today, but be open to new ports that you might be wanting to sail to throughout the course of your semester. Encourage dissent in your classroom, respectful dissent, and model openness in your, you know, in the classroom yourself. Model it. Be the model that you want the students to be.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Fueling Creativity podcast. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwin.
This show was produced by Creativity and Education and in partnership with TeachersInnovationStudio.com.
On the next episode of the Fueling Creativity podcast, we'll be speaking with Donna Luther, who leads a Montessori-based day school in Massachusetts. But until then, please continue to keep fueling the conversation using the hashtag #FuelingCreativity.